Hi, Calvin. We are now in the second part of the conversation, which you explain how in Tetrionics you came to discover gravity. We've already had a general introduction in which some fundamental ideas came in place, which is that you were not looking for gravity nor to understand gravity while you were working with Tetrionics. But by working with the principle of Tetrionics, the quantum unit and how they compose the universe as we see it, you discover that the force fields will actually create topological spatial material structures. And in that process, the force fields, the interaction of those forces leads to a kind of cancelling out, in which it is very important to understand the difference between energy and space, or time and structure, and that by looking into that you came to understand gravity. And you've described that in your Tetrionic book, and you've already said that you would like to follow through that book so that everybody can come to understand that what you have found and basically reading along in the book and now being able to listen along to the story. That's great.
Thanks, Sarah. Well, obviously, as I step through these, I'll mention the page references that the discussion relates to, but they'll be a very light overview of what each page details. It's up to the individuals to dive in and look at the pages in their full detail. But I'll give you my understanding of what I was, the basic information I was trying to convey in these illustrations as we went. Obviously, we'll start at 6102, which is the first page of the chapter on various theories of gravity. Tetrionics, as you mentioned, I didn't start out trying to use tetrionics to solve gravity. Obviously, you have to if you're developing a true unified theory. But my approach was from the ground up. I first had to understand the quantum mechanics, develop a better idea of the chemical structures, how chemistry worked, how the electromagnetic forces in QED came about, and how processes there evolved before I could even begin trying to comprehend the finesse and the absolute marvelous integration of forces that all blocks of matter have that brings about what we call universal gravitation. And as I mentioned, it's nearly impossible to discern this sort of information that's in Tetrionics from large-scale observations like what Newton and Einstein and others did. The first ones to start observing these motions were, of course, obviously the Greeks. And everyone is probably more than familiar with the different ideas that evolved over time with various theories of gravity, various theories of physics even. The first illustration there is, as I mentioned, 6102, which is Aristotle's idea of motion, which was an object goes in a straight line according to its motion, and it continues in that line. Whereas we know that the actual motion of a projectile is curved when it's acted upon by other forces. He, of course, along with many others, believed that objects of different mass have different velocities. And this is where Galileo stepped into the whole study in the Renaissance. He sat down and, whether it was true or not, he launched the balls of different weight from the Tower of Pisa and proved definitively for the first time that balls of different weight fall at the same rate. That was further expanded and proved in a vacuum conclusively with the Apollo experiments on the moon, where a feather and a hammer were dropped in the absence of an atmosphere. And they indeed both fell at the same rate. It's only the other forces at play, atmosphere and things like that, magnetic and electric fields, that creates this a situation that confuses what physics shows us to be true and what common sense often finds or struggles to accept. The next leap that came out, which is 6104, was Newton's great breakthrough, where he formulated the laws of motion, his three laws, and he applied it to gravity to show that looking at the accelerated motion of planets around the sun or satellites around the Earth, that these could best be described by an inverse squared formula, and that developing that formula, he could use it to predict the motions of the moon around the Earth, the sun around the moon, the Earth around the sun. Now I'm really mixing up the solar system. But every planet could follow this mathematical formula, which is basically a formula that says that the force between them, the attractive force between objects of matter, is proportional to their mass and inversely proportional to the distance between them. It's elegant, it's concise, and it works. And it worked and held sway for many, many years based on all the observations that were possible. Of course, it changed over time, as we'll see. And as it changed, people tried to explain the discrepancies that they were seeing. There were contemporary theories of Newton. The next illustration, 6105, shows Roger Boscovich's explanation, which strangely enough isn't too far from what actually happens. But again, it's a piece of the puzzle that doesn't explain other parts, and that's what I found with gravitation. There are many differing little aspects that have to be accounted for in order to say you have a unified theory of gravity. And it's not good enough just to match the older theories or parts of the older theories and parts of the newer theories and say, oh, I have a different interpretation or I have a different explanation. You have to be able to match them and make predictions, explain the mechanics that gives the older results, as well as why these mechanics give different results in the case that I've developed. Mathematicians, obviously, gravitation was a mathematical model. Coulomb came along, and his formulation for electrostatic interaction was remarkably similar to Newton's formulation for gravity. One was a gravitational mass in Newton's case, the other one was a charged mass in Coulomb's case. And for years, well, ever since, people have wondered what is at the core of this similarity between Coulomb's interaction law and Newton's gravitational law. It comes down to geometry, and that's shown in tetrionics. I'll explain that in a couple more slides, but because it was mathematical formula, we then started to develop mathematics to a higher degree in search of answers and further explanations and elaborations of what really could be going on in the hope of finding things. 6106 shows Gauss's explanation of how he saw Coulomb's law versus Newton's law for gravity and how he explained it in his terms of charged objects or Gaussian topologies, Gaussian geometry. That was his explanation. Again, solved some of the problems, explained some things, but not all of them. The one thing that did come out was obviously a gentleman by the name of Poisson looked at the same things and was probably one of the first to realize, maybe Gauss did, but mathematically, mathematics is just a rewriting, it's a language for geometry. If you express particles, as I've drawn here in 6107, as charged or neutral, you can then draw the fields of interaction between them as superpositioned mass energy fields, as evidenced in the rest of my work in other ebooks. In which case, you can draw in a single illustration the field of interaction between charged objects and gravitational matter. And what you see immediately is they're both the same fields. What's changing is the constant, big G or little k, the constant of interaction. In the case of gravity, it's unilateral, only convergent. In the case of Coulomb's constant, k, it's bilateral. It attracts and or detracts or repels, depending on the charges of the objects. So the similarity comes down to geometry in this case, as Tetrionics shows you. Tetrionics, all the math that has been developed in essence, and this is another entire book, all the mathematics that has been developed for physics, with few exceptions, can be represented using equilateral geometries in Tetrionics. Once this, the similarity of the scaling constants, the similarities of Gauss's formulations, Poisson's work, came about, Maxwell, using Faraday's work and Gauss's work, combined all these electric and magnetic forces that have been described mathematically into a unified equation for electromagnetism. Obviously, it was seen at that stage that K and G, very similar in mathematical formulation, just differing strengths. It was from that it was surmised that possibly there'd be another formulation that would explain gravity, just as there is a formulation to explain Coulomb's work in electromagnetic fields with Maxwell's equations. They were mathematically modified to produce a thing called a graviton. We've discussed this previously, but it's a mathematical equivalent of an electron, a photon. Whereas the photon has divergent bilateral radiant energy momenta from its source, the graviton has convergent energy momenta, focusing at the point, theoretically, to produce the strictly convergent force of gravity. And you can see at this stage how things, because of the similarity mathematically between Newton's law of gravity, Coulomb's law of charge, assumptions were being made and extrapolations were being made mathematically that had no foundation in physical modeling. Maxwell was a strong believer in testing his theoretical ideas by building a physical model that showed the mechanics that Newton could not find and openly declared he could not find or explain. Had Maxwell lived, he would have sought a mechanical model to show what was creating these physical forces, forces that we feel and observe. We feel the force of gravity. We can observe its force because the moon continues to orbit around us just as we and the moon orbit around the sun. All these things would happen. What unfortunately happened at that point was, as mathematics had become so successful in unifying and developing ideas, it was then applied further and led to the development of quantum mechanics and, at the same time, to special relativity, along with general relativity, which is an offshoot of special. 6109 was Einstein's formulation of general relativity. It relates directly to all the properties that Poisson, Rutger, that Newton, Maxwell, everyone, that everyone had suggested up until that time. Einstein took a completely fresh perspective and he viewed everything as a energy density. And he uses the stress energy tensor, which is the right hand side of that equation there, the T A B or T mu, you may hear people call it. It's got various names. It's a stress energy tensor, and it simply says that irrespective of whether it's mass or matter or a force, it is made up of energy. And where the forces are stronger or matter exists, in larger amounts, the density is changed because we're using E equals mc squared in broad terms to equate mass matter to energy. That formulation is not quite correct, as tetraionic shows, but we'll leave that alone at the moment, and we'll just go. What Einstein then did was use refined motions to give him a changed variable, whereas Newton's formulation indicated a 4 pi g with no spatial, no time component. Einstein's was 8 pi g per c to the fourth. That simply indicates a spatial coordinate based on time, c to the fourth, and we'll discuss that very shortly, introduces time into the equation, because Einstein's equations say that nothing can travel faster than speed of light. Time is a factor, whereas Newton's equations, as you look there, only have mass and distance. They have no measurement of time taking place at all. Gravity is unaffected by time. It acts instantaneously. And that was the beginning of the great divide between Newton and Einstein. 16.1.10 highlights that great divide. You have on one hand Newton, who formulated the law of universal gravitation, clearly showing and successfully demonstrating and holding sway for 300 to 400 years, his formula of instantaneous universal gravitation, acting everywhere at once, irrespective of the distance and irrespective of time. Well, it's respective of distance in that it's an inverse square, but it's acting all the time between objects. Whereas Einstein, looking at the same planets, the same motions, albeit slightly refined, as a energy density, came up with this notion that everyone's familiar with now, and that is gravity's limited by the speed of light. Gravity waves travel at sea between objects, and the planets move in their orbits not because there's a force between the objects, but because each force curves space-time slightly, and that curvature causes objects moving along those curved surfaces to follow a curved path, and that curved path is acceleration, be it gravitation or just be general acceleration. Einstein's approach, to be specific, was a different geometrical approach to Newton's. Newton observed the force that acted at all times between the objects. Einstein looked at it and said, well, perhaps it's because of the actual geometry of space and time that we feel that there's this force there. Tetraionics goes beyond both of them. But in order to go beyond both of them, we have to first do something which is abhorrent to relativity people at present, and that is we have to separate space and time from each other. They're not the notion of space-time as purported or suggested by Einstein was simply his way of expressing the energy densities and how this, it was analogous. There are many discussions about whether it's right or wrong. Let's put them aside at the moment and concentrate on simply what we have to do in order to rationalize and unify these theories of gravity. The first thing, and this is where tetraionics comes to the fore because of its work in developing clear understandings of mass, energy, and matter, and spatial coordinates. 6202 is an illustration that shows that if you take, just as Einstein said, mass and matter can all be described in terms of energy density, if you exclude all the energy out of a region of space, and that by definition will include mass and matter, you are literally left with a region of empty space. There is no energy in it, there is no mass, there is no matter, and I will show that there is no time component associated with that region. It is simply a spatial plane or a spatial volume, as indicated in that illustration. You can develop a coordinate system to put boundaries on that spatial region or that spatial volume in order to measure the physics going on in that spatial volume. But in order to have physics going on in that spatial volume, again, you have to put energy back into it. Einstein's general and special theory of relativity deals with, or general in particular, deals with energy density. So we could put it all back in as energy, and we would have Einstein's description of the universe, a spatial region with energy density inside it. Tetrionics goes further, and it designates, and not only designates, but it differentiates and geometrically draws the shape and topology of mass and matter in that region. You can have equilateral mass energy, diamond-shaped mass energies, or you can have 4-pi charged matter topologies. Mass energy geometries, matter topologies. Again, they always come together, and you'll see them time and time again. So how do we create these spatial volumes? Well, we borrow from Einstein. It's very simple to create a spatial coordinate system for any region of space in order to measure the physics within it. All you do is you take a measurement of time and you say, if the speed of light is the limiting factor, which we as I said, we're borrowing from special relativity, it could be the speed of camel, but we choose the speed of light as it being the highest velocity supposedly available. If we, as per the previous picture, send out a vector or a beam of light in one direction for 1 second, we form one axis of a coordinate system. If we were to send a second one down in the opposite direction, for example, we would form two axes, which would in turn form a circle. And that is what C squared is. C gives you a vector force in one direction. C squared, as per that illustration, a beam of light radiating from the center over a period of time, n seconds, goes a certain distance, 1 second, almost to the moon. So that circle would enclose the Earth, but not quite to the moon. But it gives you a circular region of space, a planar region of space at C squared. If you were to do another beam of light, you would have three. And before I begin discussing that, I'll just say 6204 is the illustration that really sums it up. A single beam of light is a force, as shown in that illustration. C squared creates a circular planar circumference in which no amount of energy could exceed. It has to be within that region. C to the third creates Cartesian coordinates, X, Y, and Z, if you like. It creates a cubic volume of space in which we can place mass energy, or in which we can measure the changes and interactions of mass, energy, matter, and their forces. And that's what we call physics. Because we measure light in terms of 1 second intervals, C squared, so 1 second is C squared, what Newton's idea of a second becomes Einstein's C squared, we can develop a third and final coordinate system, which is a spherical coordinate system for measuring physics, which is just two beams of light perpendicular to each other. C squared by C squared is C to the fourth. Four axes. It creates a volume of space in which we can measure these physics. Again, if there's no energy, or no mass and no matter within these coordinate systems, it's referred to in tetrionics as empty space. The reality is space has energy in it in the form of vacuum energies. So there's physics going on. We have planar, flat, mass energy geometries, and matter topologies within any chosen coordinate system, and they all create differing physics. And that's where tetrionics gets a real go on. So the final thing, now that we've differentiated space and spatial coordinates, empty space, things like that, is to explain what time is compared to what Einstein said. Einstein said time was this foam. It was the rubbery sheet that's bent to cause the curved motion of planets. Tetrionics is completely different. It has a completely different take. 6206 quickly discusses space and time. The sheet itself that you can see there with a background grid of equilateral triangles, the background grid is simply the vacuum energies. There's always energy in a region of space. But as we add energy, mass energy particularly, into those regions, because energy per second is energy divided by c squared. Remember, c squared is 1 second. Gives us e divided by c squared, which is mass. So if you have a spatial coordinate system, be it c squared, c to the fourth, around an object of energy, any form of energy, it's simply a form of mass. That mass becomes matter, as illustrated on this page, simply when it has topology, when it forms atoms with molecules, elements, compounds. That's matter. It has a 3D topology. The peculiar thing, the thing that shows up early, not very early, but certainly by QED, is that the quantized angular momentum, the equilateral geometry, the equilateral shape itself of energy, is measured in square meters. You put that in a c squared, square meters per second. You measure that in a c squared, or 1 second region of space, as we've done here. You then have angular momentum divided by c squared. I'm just trying to find the right illustration here. I seem to have jumped. There it is. We are now on to... It did jump. Illustration... ...6213. The quantized angular momentum, the equilateral geometry of positive and negative charges in tetrionics, is represented by omega, which is square meters per second. You'll see that most commonly in Planck's constant, mass, angular momentum, kilograms, square meters per second. Square meters per second, or angular momentum, quantized angular momentum, as I put it, per c squared, when you do the math on it, gives you seconds. So if that's a measurement of seconds and you want a measurement of time, what you need to do is measure the changing quantized angular momentum, the changing Planck quanta in a system per c squared. That will then give you delta seconds, and changing time forward or backwards is time. Changing seconds, I should say, forward or backwards is time. This is another place where relativity has confused one physical property for another. What relativity calls a direction of time, not the entropic direction of time, but the time of direction of time within relativistic formulations, is in fact, well, what they call plus and minus time, the direction of time in relativity, is in fact plus and minus charge. So in the prior illustration, 6212, and I did reverse them around for a particular reason, we can see that mass angular momentum is charge, mass seconds. So mass angular momentum is Planck's quantum, Planck's constant. You take Planck's constant per c squared, and you get mass seconds. That is charge in SI units, as opposed to if you look up charge as a form of impedance or permittivity or permeability, you'll get all sorts of confused SI units for those for charge, because they've developed over time from the measurement, how we measure it, rather from a ground-up approach like this. So we show that time in physics is simply where we measure, we define a region of space, and then we look at it to see if the Planck quanta, the equilateral pluses and minuses, change. If they change, we can measure that change, be it as a force, be it as a release of light, be it as motion of particles. They're all forms of Planck quanta moving. We can measure them, and we can then measure the physics within that spatial region. If there was no changing quantized angular momenta within that system, there we would say time stood still, because to the observer, nothing would happen. There would be no motion of a clock. There would be no motion of no kinetic energy, no forces, no change of the particles of mass, energy, or matter, no changes of energy density. So in order to have time, we must have changing quantized angular momenta, delta QAM or delta omega, within a region of space. As I mentioned, the plus and minus time in relativity is plus and minus charge. So now we're starting to see how we don't have space-time in relativity. We have space and the energy within that spatial region. If it changes, gives us time. If it doesn't change, we have no way of measuring time. But it's that, it's the presence of energy, be it mass, energy, or matter, within the spatial region that gives us the physics of force and whether we have fields and or particles under measurement. And it's the changing quantized angular momenta, the changing geometries of those, of the energy in all its forms within that spatial region, that gives us a measurement of time, or even a perception of time. Gives us both. That is the quantum source of time. And in fact, we can then show logically through that that time is quantized. It is a measure of equilateral geometry per c squared. Just as mass is energy per c squared. It's an they're both analogous to each other. One is energy is the scalar property of the equilateral triangle, whereas the quantized angular momentum is simply the equilateral geometry. So changing geometry is time, change, and scalar energy is mass. If that mass were to fold into a topology, we would have matter. So hopefully, as I've explained it there, we've now got a clear understanding of the differences between mass, energy, matter, space, and time. And they are all critical that that understanding be there before you try to understand the mechanics of gravitation. Because as I said before, matter produces a different force when it's placed in a region of space that has energy. It displaces those vacuum energies to create gravity. And equally, mass energy in any region performs a different function. It creates radiant mass energies that always try to escape the boundary. But as they do so, they interact with other mass energies and other forms of matter. Where they interact directly with matter, they create a force of motion. They push on it. Where they superposition, one on top of each other, they form interactive forces that can attract or repel bodies of matter towards each other, depending on the charge distribution within those atoms. And remembering that it's charge itself that creates the topology of matter. So all matter has positive and negative charges. In most cases, the charges neutralize out. But even though they're neutral, they still attract and repel each other through these fields of force of mass energy. So mass, energy, matter create the forces that we see between objects of matter. So if you want, you could actually describe energy or mass as energy density per C squared or per M squared square meter. And likewise with matter, you could describe it as energy per C to the fourth, because it has to be a spatial volume to enclose the topology. Or you can describe it as energy density, rho, per square meter. There are different ways of measuring it, but you can do all that in terms of energy, and that will give you the energy densities of relativity. And these energy densities, although very useful mathematically in Einstein's formulations, give you no, they're only a generalization of the energy density, how much mass energy is in one spot compared to another, or more precisely, how much energy is in one spot. As I've drawn there, the mapping of energy densities is no different to the mapping of atmospheric pressure densities on the planet. They can be useful for forecasting, for mapping what's currently going on, but they give no real indication as to how the physics are working. The final thing I want to touch on before we probably best to close up this quick discussion is the mass energy that's always present, as I said, in spatial coordinates. In our current universe, when you form a spatial coordinate system, by nature it's going to have objects in it, which are the physics. Even if we could remove all the particles and heat out of the field, we would find, out of that spatial region, we'd find that there's still energy within it. This energy that's within empty, so-called empty space, has gone by various names over the years. It's been called vacuum energies, the ether, the Higgs field, many, many names, many descriptions. Ether went out of favor because of Michelson and Morley's experiments. And Einstein's relativity. Currently the favor is the Higgs field, which is a nice way of saying the ether without actually saying it. Tetrionics has a lot more detailed information on the mechanics of the Higgs field. The Higgs field itself is simply one charged fascia of any matter topology. So where matter exists, it has charged fascia. Baryons, for example, have 36 charged fascia. Each one of those you can say is a Higgs field. So you could equivalently say that a proton has 36 Higgs fields. Within those charged fascia are mass, energy, Planck quanta. And they are inductive loops, and that's what gives the inertial mass to matter. It's the topology of matter, the charge topology, precisely, that gives it inertial properties. Now, the ether itself is simply radiated mass energies. As I said, when matter's formed, it radiates fields of heat, of electromagnetic radiation, out into the region around it. That energy will continue to expand out at the speed of light, or the velocity of whatever the medium is. If it encounters some air along the way, it will slow down accordingly. The velocity is always determined of electromagnetic fields. It's always determined by the impedance of the region of space that it's moving through. Most people say it works out that in simple terms, the impedance of the ether in free space is such that this, a photon moving through it will travel at the speed of light. If the medium changed to glass or water, the photon slows down accordingly because it has more, there's more impedance to its motion. So see, the speed of light is the speed of light in a vacuum, as it's properly stated. Or even more properly, it should be stated, is the speed of light in a vacuum due to its impedance. Because that impedance may in fact change if you have particles of matter or stronger electromagnetic fields around stars, etc. The dynamics of mass geometries and matter topologies within the rarefied vacuum energies of any spatial region is what gives rise to universal gravitation. And that's what that illustration 63.01 is all about. It is there to show that, just as Einstein did, you can describe things as a form, mass and matter as forms of energy, providing you understand what the spatial coordinate systems are. To this date, there are scientists that will give you a blank look when you ask them what the C squared and E equals MC squared means, or what the 1 over C squared means in impedance, or in the electric permittivity or the magnetic permeability formulations. Just as equally, they will not be able to explain what E to the third, or E cubed, in entropy is representing, or what E to the fourth quadratic, oh sorry, C to the fourth quadratic C represents in general relativity. To them, it's a time measurement, but in fact, it is setting the stage, if you like, for this puppet show that we discussed. It is putting the bounds by using the speed of light on a region of space, and everything that is within that region of space, be it mass, energy, or matter, can then be defined as the physics of that space. In tetrionics, we have equilateral mass energies. Those equilateral mass energies are referred to as geometries. They are planar, flat, and radiant. We also have matter, 3D matter topologies. They have a volume, they take up a space, and they displace vacuum energy. And that's the important point that I'll make here, the final point on that illustration. Right at the very center, you'll see the green arrows pointing into a hexagon. That's the convergent gravitational force. The circular gradient at the base of the page is the gradient of energy, getting stronger and stronger, more and more energy as you approach this hexagonal block of matter. That block of matter has displaced the vacuum energies, so there is nothing in the center of that matter. Inside matter is a thing called null space. It's the only place in the universe that has no energy. Energy cannot penetrate it because the charge mass energies of tetrahedra are such that they form Faraday cages. So inside matter, there is absolutely no energies. No mass, no energies. So when matter is created, it pushes out or displaces the vacuum energies that are normally found in our spatial region. Those vacuum energies then seek to equalize under the second law of tetrionics. And in seeking to equalize, they create a convergent force. They push back against this displacement. Obviously, the matter has more energy or mass energy in its topologies. It's a engineered design. It is stronger than weak vacuum energies pushing back on it. Just as a balloon inflated under the water is able to resist the water pushing back on it. In addition to that, you'll see that there's blue lines radiating out with black and red triangles superimposed on them. The black and red triangles represent positive and negative charges, plus and minus Planck masses, and those masses radiate out from matter into the surrounding vacuum energies to create vacuum energies in turn. As they get further and further away from this point of source, they get weaker until they form vacuum energies. Where they superposition, i.e. overlap, red and black like you see there, they create the additional fields of force, which is convergent and divergent. That is a summary of how the basic mechanics of universal gravitation comes about. What we've covered so far is the introductory components that all go together and all act together to give us what Newton described as gravity and what Einstein described as curvature of space-time. We've now separated the space from the time, the mass from the matter, the geometry from the topology, the quantum from the cosmological. And what we now have is the stage fully set, primed, for us to go into a real investigation of the mechanics of universal gravitation.
Marvelous, Galvin. I suggest that we end this part of the recording.
Yeah.
And then pick it up in a separate track, that we keep the recording quality clear. And it's beautiful and amazing how essentially you make everything simple by simply discerning between the different dimensions and see how that comes across in the separation of time and space, but also energy and resulting force fields. So let's pick that up again in the next part of this. And wonderful. Thank you. I'll come right back.